Wind Trust Business Lunchtime. There's Tom Gimbel. Tom, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I am great, John Williams. How are you doing?
Good. Tom's the founder of the LaSalle Network. And Tom, we saw a story the other day that said, here are some of the mistakes that Gen Zers make when they go for a job interview. And one of the things they said 19% of them do are go to the job interview with their parents, have their parents actually, I don't know if they're in the room or in the Zoom meeting, but I thought that can't be true. What was your reaction to that?
I think some of that's clickbait, John. I really do. And I've seen and I've heard stories where there's been some parents that drop their kids off, and maybe they're down in the lobby of the building and things. And I think it's also a variety of positions, and they don't get too descriptive into the types of jobs, I don't believe, in the survey. And so, but I think it's more to get a reaction and a narrative, whether there's a little bit of gray or not. So to me, that's not where I spend my time. It's more on what people want and trying to get people to understand what you need to do to get your career going in the right way when you get out of college.
When I graduated from college, I interviewed for a job at a radio station in Aurora. Didn't get the job, but there I was, and my dad drove me to the interview and waited in the parking lot. I don't exactly remember why we did it that way. I could have driven, but I think my dad was there for a little support, and maybe we prepped on the way. I'm sure we did. But my dad didn't go in there with me, and I think that
right. So was your dad there? Was he not there? You know, I have a son that lives with me. I have a daughter that just graduated college that lives with me over the summer. And if she had an interview in the loop, maybe I'd walk with her on my way to work. Like, I think there's a lot of different narratives on that versus going to the interview.
Okay, all right. So while that strains credulity, I do believe some of the other findings of this survey, which said that the percentage of them that use inappropriate language in the interview or refuse to turn on the camera during a Zoom interview, those do seem to be plausible to me.
Yeah, you know what used to happen. I'm 52, as you know, and when I 30 years ago, if you went on an interview and the person you were interviewing with used a curse word, you didn't use one as well. That they're the boss, they're the employer. How they speak is how they speak, and today it opens up Pandora's box, so to speak. That then all of a sudden there isn't that level of respect or do as I say, not as I do type of mentality. And I think that's the casual nature of the world we live in. You know, I also used to call all my friends' parents Mr. and Mrs., and today kids call all the friends' parents by their first name. So the world has changed.
Do you suggest that new hires refer to their superiors as Mr. or Mrs., or should they use their first name?
I think in the interview you refer to people as Mr. or Mrs. until they tell you not to.
And
now, if you're interviewing with somebody who's under the age of 30 and it's a peer or a supervisor potentially, you know, I think this is where emotional intelligence and using your judgment really comes in handy. But if you're interviewing with somebody who's got you by a bunch of years or has a title of, you know, director, vice president, a C-level title, it never hurts to be respectful of people, ever. Never hurts.
What do you see young people doing especially well, or what are some of the big mistakes that you see either young hires or young prospective hires make?
I think the number one thing is having a little bit more formality in the process. So writing an actual thank you note and sending an email and asking to come in person to interview if it's in the same city where you live versus deferring to virtual, getting places a half hour early so you're not late. I think some of those fundamentals are really important. And the other thing that's happened, you know, just through the pandemic and then with the Zoom and everything being virtual, is eye contact and manners have really fallen by the wayside. So when you see somebody who stands up when somebody comes into a room, who makes eye contact with you and can hold eye contact, those are the social tools. There was just an article written, I can maybe get it for next week, John, where it said that with the emergence of AI, that sales, jobs, and interpersonal skills are the most valuable commodity because the STEM ability won't be as necessary due to AI. And it was really interesting because I think due to the pandemic, remote learning, remote jobs, that a lot of the social skills have fallen by the wayside. So we kind of need to circle the wagons on this one.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN with Tom Gimbel, our guest, the founder of LaSalle Network. Tom, we were just talking about mistakes that young people make sometimes when they're applying for or interviewing for a job. I'm glad that you said the one thing you did, which was that a little bit of formality doesn't hurt. Nobody's ever going to criticize you for saying Mr. or Mrs. or showing up early, right?
Yeah. You know what? We shouldn't hire that kid. They were too polite. It was never said by anybody.
It was never right? said.
Unless you're applying for a job at the Wiener Circle, I think that
yes, right.
you can err on the side of being polite.
A47 said, I interview candidates a lot. Kids do not have any social skills these days. John, my ex-husband lost his job as a policeman in the western suburbs. His father went in to plead for him to get the job back. And 630 said, kids are so sharp, but many lack social skills. You know, I don't know how long the impact of the pandemic is going to linger. But if you talk to somebody who is a teacher in a high school dealing with kids who lost a couple of years of socialization, they will make you cry with what they have to deal with.
People don't want to, and I can't figure out why the corporate community, why the government, why everybody doesn't listen to that, because I've heard the same thing from high school teachers, that these kids don't have the social interaction, they're behind academically, their ability to concentrate, and it is, there's a period of adjustment that goes on after 2 years of what we went through. And it's the same thing in the workplace. And so, you know, the best opportunity for, in my mind, is for kids graduating college, you either have to go into a company that's big enough that has a real training program that's going to train you, or go into a company that's small enough that you are under a microscope, that you have to do every job in the place and they know exactly what's going on. Because if you're in no man's land, in purgatory, where it's not big enough for a training program but too big that everybody doesn't know what's going on, you're going to slack off and you're going to get hurt.
Do you think that it's possible that chatbots, AI-empowered computers will interview people at least in the first round of a job process?
It's already happening, John.
Really?
It's already happening. And quite frankly, I'm not sure that that's necessarily a bad thing, because what you end up happening is candidates, not all of them, but there's a lot of candidates that lie. And there's companies that lie, too. I'm just saying one side of the equation for this purpose, is that they'll lie about things in order to get in, and then they get in, and then they're wasting everybody's time. Mm-hmm. And so if you can have a part that's automated, whether it's a written automation or a verbal automation with a chatbot, where you can just knock off a half a dozen questions of this, this, and this, then at least the people on the other side know that you meet those qualifications.
I wonder how the chatbot knows that you're lying, or, I mean, really, what does that do for...
Well, you could lie to the chatbot, but now there's a record, right? So now when you come in and somebody asks you something, you're classified by what you answered. You know, it's one of those things. If you say you've never been convicted of a felony and they find out you've been convicted of a felony, they can fire you, right? And so that's the extreme example. But if they ask if you have experience working on a software package that's a mandatory aspect of the job and you lie about it, then you go in, you know, those are the things that they're trying to cut through. It's not really the emotional intelligence, social interaction. It's, you know, are you available to work Monday through Friday? Are you available to work 8 a.m. to 5 p.m.? Or if it's a night shift, are you available to work nights? It's those types of questions that are more check-the-box type stuff that we're seeing it being used.
Yeah, right. How much are you hearing from either employers or employees about AI eliminating jobs? How much stress out there is out
there? Yeah, I think I don't really see it yet. I think we're a few years off. You know, it's interesting because you have different sets of people, and sometimes people are talking out of both sides of their mouth, right? Is if I get my job done, what difference does it make where I do it? Okay, well, if I can have a computer do your job, what difference does it make if I do that? And everybody wants what's good for them. And I think in reality that the more you're, and this is reverting back to my hot topic, and you know this, is if you're in the office, you have more exposure than just your job responsibilities. And as AI takes over more chores, tasks, right, that the more exposure you have to other sides of the business, the more valuable you become, because AI doesn't have that. And so the more connected you are to different departments, to different managers, to different people, in addition to just doing the tasks on your job, the more valuable you are and the less chance of you being replaced.
Well, the big macro issue relative to AI, it seems to me, is not will these machines replace people, but will they better empower people, people in general, maybe not you today in that job, but will they be tools that we're going to use or will they completely replace us? That's, I don't have the answer to that question, but that is the question, right?
Yeah, that's 100% the question. But the reality is that they will enhance people at doing their job, number one. Number two, they will replace tasks of people's jobs, which means that people will get to focus on higher level things. It should raise the bar for a lot of people. And it's you know, replacing the person that did horseshoes and becoming a mechanic on the cars, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about, is the evolution of jobs. And that's been going on since cavemen, right? There's always been efficiencies, and we don't use donkeys to plow the fields anymore, and there's still jobs for people, and you got to have mechanics to fix the cars and the tractors and the airplanes, and we'll continue to do that.
Tom Gimbel's the founder of the LaSalle Network. Nice to talk to you as always, Tom. We'll visit next week.
Stay cool. It's getting hot this week, John.
Yeah, it's coming. Lovely today, though. Some of my colleagues here, I came in with a long sleeve shirt, and now I got a sweater on. John Williams here with our friend Dennis Rodkin, the senior reporter covering residential real estate over at Crane's Chicago Business. Welcome back to the studio.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm pretty good. What a beautiful day downtown.
Oh, it is. Yeah, the walk from my newsroom to yours was a lot of fun.
We're downtown Chicago at 303 East Wacker. We're 18 stories up overlooking the tour boats going up and down the Chicago River, the blue sky, and lots of folks enjoying a day like today in this city. We've had a nice run, haven't we?
We really have. It's been a beautiful spring, early summer.
I wonder if, like college campus visits, the weather the day you go is critical to buying or selling a house.
Well, you know, one of the things I heard about Northwestern, when they built a big admissions building right there on Sheridan Road, they essentially replaced an old parking lot that was on the lakefront, is that they did that in part so that when kids arrive, the first thing they see is, oh my God, look at this lake, as opposed to, I don't know where admissions was previously, but that was part of the story, is they built, it's a multi-story building with, I think, parking underneath. So you come into your admissions interview, you're several stories off the ground looking out at Lake Michigan. You know, you're some kid from Iowa, Nebraska. You're probably thinking, this is the place I want to be.
Or Palos. I mean,
Palos.
That's cheating when you can say, well, let's just sit here and overlook the beautiful Lake Michigan. Do you want to come to school here? And by the way, that'll be $92,000 a year. I think Vanderbilt just hit $100,000.
Oh, wow.
$100,000. I don't know that anybody ever pays those prices. You know, anybody that could go to Vanderbilt's probably smart enough to get a scholarship.
And I would think the same at Northwestern, of course. Yeah
right. By the way, nice weather. How's the real estate market doing in the Chicago area?
You know, it's been doing quite well, in large part because inventory is so short. You know, we're in those same conditions we've been for quite a while now. Inventory is super short, in large part because so many people have interest rates from before the inflation busting interest rate hikes. So I've got a 3% mortgage. And to move, even if I moved dollar for dollar, same value, which is not really what people most often do, I'm going to be paying so much more because interest rates have risen so much. Therefore, I don't put the house on the market. Therefore, those who are looking for a home, either new family formation, coming to town, for whatever reason I need a home, they're having to pay up, often paying over the asking price, just to get the few houses that are on the market.
I think it's interesting you mention inventory, though. Elise Glink was on with us yesterday, and she said the lack of fluidity in the market right now is more a function of inventory than interest rates. You agree with that?
I would think they're kind of chasing each other, right? I mean, there are other reasons that inventory, there isn't much inventory on the market. We don't build as many new homes in the Chicago area as in other regions and others, but a large part of it is when you look at the number of properties listed, it's super low. And I really do, from anecdotal evidence, talking to people, find that there are a heck of a lot of people who say, I can't let go of this mortgage. So I think the two sort of feed each other.
I was thinking that maybe 7% is going to be the new 4%, that's just going to be the standard to which people will go.
Sure. And as we adjust to it, you and I have talked about this before. Our parents were buying houses in the 80s for double-digit interest rates or over 10%. We'll get used to it. And you know, we still, we get married, we have children, we get divorced, one spouse dies. There are reasons to move, and people will have to get used to it. It's just that right now, 20 years of very low interest rates is relatively fresh in our memory. And so if I don't have to move, I'm not going to.
But what are we to make of the fact that anecdotally you and I hear stories from family and friends? I went to buy a house. There were multiple offers. The seller got more than asked. I wasn't a cash buyer. Maybe I was even a cash buyer, but another cash buyer, $10,000 more generous than me, got the house. That still happens, right?
Oh, it absolutely does. I just did a story within the last couple of weeks about Hillary Wirtz, the daughter of Rocky Wirtz, and a member of the firmament there in the Wirtz family empire. She got more than 30% over her asking price. Put her house on the market in Wilmette, sold it in a very short time, got more than 30% over her asking price.
Wow. And was probably a cash buyer,
I assume, because it happened really fast. So generally, that's a cash buyer.
But aren't the houses in Wilmette, I mean, are people borrowing money for million-dollar houses or not? I always assumed that if, especially in this market, if you're going to buy a house like that and you'd prefer the interest rates to be 2% instead of 7%, those people don't care because they've got cash, no?
Well, you know, there was an interesting thing when interest rates were really dropping far, and that was the people who can afford to pay cash were getting mortgages anyway because a mortgage was so cheap they could put their cash in something else.
Point.
I would imagine we're seeing a shift back toward that. But the thing is, if you're buying a $1.7 million house in the Chicago area, you're not necessarily all that wealthy. I do know people buy houses for $200,000. $1.7 million is a lot. But those aren't necessarily people who are flush with money.
Well, how much did this Wirtz house cost? What was she selling it?
I don't have it in front of me. I think they were asking about one. I believe they were asking 1.1, and it sold for about 1.4, but like I don't have the story in front of me. But those are not necessarily people who have a giant wad of cash and other assets. They're salaried people and needing to borrow. When you get to the $5, $10 million range, yeah, those people are much more likely to be paying
cash. What was that story you were telling me off the air? Has that been published about the one condo that sold for less than it was previously listed as?
It's on the market now. It's a story that I think was posted just as I was walking over here. There's a two-story penthouse on the top of a 1920s building on Astor Street. Came on the market in 2019. At just about $8 million, just below $8 million. Hasn't sold in the 5 years since. The price came down. Now it's up for auction. The auction closes June 20th. The highest bid as of now, published on the auction site, is $1.75 million. The auctioneer is asking who's going to go to $1.85 million. And again, the asking price 5 years ago was $8 million, and now you're asking, will you come up closer to $2 million? Somebody, if the auction concludes the way it looks like it will, somebody may get that beautiful penthouse in an Andrew Ribori building with interiors by David Adler, later redone in the 50s by Samuel Marx. These are some high-end names in the history of the Gold Coast. Somebody may get that for about a quarter of what the sellers were asking 5 years ago.
It's got the granite countertops.
I don't remember the countertops, but it has marble floors in the foyer, arched doorways, herringbone floors, all sorts of beautiful features.
Well, that's anomalous, though, right? I mean,
The Gold Coast has been behaving very differently from, well, and downtown Chicago in general, but the Gold Coast is especially true. It has been very different from other parts of the city and other parts of the region. I did a story last week, I think you might have it in your pile, where there was a comparison of downtown prices versus the rest of the city prices in major cities across America. And in the past 10 years, downtown prices in Chicago have grown at a in the past 10 years, downtown prices in 31 out of 40 cities have grown slower than home prices in the rest of the city.
Yeah.
In Chicago, it's even worse. Downtown prices have gone down, so they haven't even been able to rise slower than the rest of the market. They're going down while the rest of the city of Chicago has done far better. We have really had a problem with downtown home sales.
Producer Pete just handed me the article you referred to about the Gold Coast penthouse up for auction. And look at that. Oh, who doesn't want to live there? And there's some interior pictures, too. That marble circular entryway floor and the chandelier and the arch doorways. Oh, my goodness. I may buy this thing.
Well, the top bid right now is $1.75 million, John.
Oh, I got that. That's no problem.
You got it. They're asking for $1.85
at this moment. I wouldn't have bought it for $8 million. Wow. Well, somebody, I presume they're not upside down on this property.
They've owned it for about 50 years. The seller only spoke to me in 2019, did not speak to me for this story. And at that time, he said they'd owned it for about 45 years. I don't know exactly when they bought it. But if you've had it for 50 years, you very likely are not upside down. Speaking Most likely you paid it off a long time ago.
Dennis Rodkin, talk to me, senior residential reporter or reporter covering residential real estate over at Cranes, about the Home Alone house.
Sold so fast. So this is another example of quick sales, short inventory. There aren't many homes listed for over $5 million in Winnetka. That's in part because they go so fast. It's a remarkable house. These sellers bought it from the people who lived there when Home Alone was filmed there. They bought it in about 2012, I think, for under $2 million, but they then essentially doubled the size of the house. I can't remember the numbers. They're in my story. I think it went from 4,100 to 8,000 square feet. They added a much larger kitchen, basketball gym, family room, two-car garage. So it's a far larger house than it was. But they put it on the market a couple weeks ago at $5.25 million, and a week later, it was under contract. The interesting thing about it is, it's so well-known. It really co-starred in the movie Home Alone, which came out in 1990. It's so recognizable. They got press coverage all over the world that their house had gone on the market. And one of the really interesting things that happened subsequently was about a week later, there's an incident in Winnetka where some guys are trying to break into a house and the homeowner comes out with a gun and shoots at them. I don't know if you remember that news story. That house is not the Home Alone house, looks a lot like it. Colonial, white trim, black shutters. And so if you looked at the where the news sites posted about that, people were saying either, oh, is that the Home Alone house where this happened? Or they were saying, that is the Home Alone house where this happened. And it's not. But the kind of interesting thing is it's two guys who, break into a house. They could be the Wet Bandits Home Alone.
Right.
This house, the Home Alone house, is it's stately. It's walkable to downtown Winnetka, just a few blocks. It's walkable to their lakes. It would be a great house anyway, but it has this incredible profile from starring in a Christmas classic. The other one from a John Hughes movie that came on the market right around the same time is the house in Kenilworth where Steve Martin's character lived in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And it has this important sort of impact toward the end where Steve Martin brings home loser John Candy and they're walking down the street to this beautiful, snow-shrouded, warm home. So it, too, is very familiar. It has taken much longer to sell. It has not yet gone under contract, though the Home Alone house took a week.
Here's the numbers from your story about the Home Alone house. They added about 5,100 square feet to the existing 4,000.
There we go.
It's 9,000 square feet.
Not atypical in Winnetka, don't forget.
Really? Not atypical?
Yeah.
Some people have 8,000 and 9,000 square foot homes.
Well, there's a guy building a 53,000 square foot house. But yeah, there are, 9,000 square feet, not unusual for Hinsdale, for Winnetka, for any of the other towns on the North Shore, for St. Charles as well.
I don't even know what that looks like.
It's your house, my house, and another one.
Right. Because most people are, about 2,200, 2,500?
Yeah, I think 2,300, 2,500 is more typical.
All right. Okay, Dennis, you've got a lot here. We're out of time. It's 12:57. Dennis Rodkin. You can read these stories and more with photos Chicagobusiness.com?
Chicagobusiness.com, yep.
Crane, Chicago Business, residential real estate reporter Dennis Rodkin. Nice to see you, Dennis.